Only in Jeff Styles America.
Hi, folks. Jeff Styles here, spelled with a Y. This is Fred Podcast, fredpodcast.com, and Only in Jeff Styles America, the final chapter of Only in Jeff Styles America, the story of what happened to me starting June 15th of last year, 2018, coming up next week. Finally, everything has been resolved, and I feel that I can be completely honest and free to say what I need to say about the way things went down on that. It cost me a 2.5-decade career in talk radio. I am back on talk radio at Nougat FM, and Fred the Show still continues from 9 to 10 at 92.7 on the FM band here in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But NougatRadio.com, they do streaming audio, and they do Facebook Live during all their live shows. And I'm on from 7 to 10 every day, but Fred the Show and Fred Podcast go together. Fred, it just stands for free radio every day, if this is the first one you've ever listened to. Now, normally, I start off with some news, some headlines. That was my bread and butter for years. But to be honest with you, this is the first time since I started doing this. And this was the old podcast thing was back in mid-August of last year. Again, 2018. And I've not missed a week yet. I've missed 2 weeks, essentially, for all practical purposes. And my techno Sherpa through this adventure, Strat Parrot, hopefully got out the message yesterday as to why. And that is because I've been very, very sick. And I'm dealing with some sort of Andromeda strain that has affected my voice and really, really laid me low. And I was just really miserable for a long time. But last week it culminated in me having just massive attacks of high blood pressure. My blood rate went, my pulse rate went through the roof and I started throwing up. I guess Thursday, I know that the dates don't matter, but let's just put it to you this way. I think you can follow the calendar. On Thursday at lunch, I ate a full meal. I did not eat again until I was in the hospital emergency room on Tuesday morning at about 1:30 a.m. That's how bad it was. When I talk about throwing up, I'm talking about throwing up. I became terribly dehydrated. But the whole thing affected my voice. It affected my mood. It affected my energy. So I literally just didn't have it in me. So today, here's the headlines. Idiots run the world. There's a hot war that's been breaking out in Indian Pakistan that nobody's covering. We've had tornadoes in Alabama when we shouldn't be having tornadoes. Mueller is still hanging on to some of the information he's got on the investigation into collaboration, and Congress says they want it. Screw all that. That's not important right now, and I haven't been able to keep up anyway. I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago about characters and the characters in my life. And I talked about one person in particular and I got very emotional, surprised me. And this is going, there is a linear path to this conversation today or this monologue. I don't have a guest. It's just me. I hope my voice holds out. And I do have subscribers out there. I have advertisers. Thank you to Kelly Subaru, Tim Kelly, and the good folks down at kellysubaru.com. Thank you to Robin Ring, with an I, and Robin with a Y, and RC2 Realty Solutions, rc2realtysolutions.com. And she now deals with mostly distressed properties, but can still find you a place if you it used to be RMJ Tactical, and these are the people that are now making blades for all outdoor sports. And this Friday, on my radio show, again, I know that the dates don't make any difference to people listening to podcasts. There's going to be the first in RMJ USA's Explore More program on Fred the Show, on my radio show. And it's going to be all about creeking, creek boating, steep creek paddling, which right now this is the season for it. And yesterday when I finally left the hospital, I felt good enough to actually go to one of the creeks where people paddle things, and I am a whitewater paddler. I'm a kayaker, but I would never do these runs. And I went out there just to shoot some video and talk to some folks about who were the best at it, and I'm looking forward to that. But there is a line to this, so please forgive my stream of consciousness of what seems like it's going to be rambling. But I wanted to go back to characters. Then we're going to go to Mexico. Then we're going to go to the ER, the emergency room. And this all ties in, believe it or not. Thanks to all those advertisers and thanks to the subscribers. I'm sorry I left you hanging there. One of the greatest characters in my life, and I've mentioned him before, and he is still one of my very best friends today. His name is Steve Harper, and everybody calls him Tarzan. I don't even know if 9 out of 10 people who know him even know what his name is. He's always been known as Tarzan. My family had a, you know, their hometown, and I guess I used to say it was my hometown, you know, even when I lived in the Midwest, was Bowdoin, Georgia, a tiny little bitty town, right down there on the Alabama border. And I was down there during the holidays and summers, and only knew a couple of people, really. And when I was a freshman in high school, we moved down there, and I moved down first, and then my family followed because they had to sell the house up in Ohio. And one of the first new people I met through the friends that I did have who were both older than me was Steve Tarzan, and a very interesting character he was. And I'm not sure he really liked me much at first, but we became soulmates, you know, shortly after. And it didn't take long to realize why they called him Tarzan. He wore nothing but a pair of cut-off denim shorts. Remember, this was the 70s. All year long, he did not wear a shirt unless he had to go to school. He did not wear shoes unless somebody made him. No matter how cold it got, no matter what the weather was or the situation was, his feet, like mine were pretty much back in that day, were like leather, and he ran everywhere he went. He didn't walk fast. He didn't ride a bike. He didn't have a car. I mean, I was a freshman. He was a sophomore. I don't know how old he was, but he ran. He just ran. And he had this flaming red hair. And, you know, as young men in a rural town, we still climbed a lot of trees back in those days. This guy was an absolute master climber. And he had no fear. He was the most athletic person I've ever known in my life. He would leap from limb to limb. And he did set up, yes, incredible rope swings or cable swings that went out over gullies that if you let go you would die. I've actually still got one of those on my property. I feel like it's my obligation to my heritage to put up a death swing wherever I live, and or over a body of water where you would let go and then be able to do a 1.5 or a gainer into the swimming hole. And I remember, just as we were becoming friends, he lived right on the main road, which we had one stoplight in that town. So the main road wasn't very long and it wasn't very populated, but his family had a very nice home right there on the main road. And his dad, and he topped a tree. I guess it was endangering the house, but I just remember riding by. It was about 45, 50 feet up, and it was just topped level, you know, 90 degrees, no limbs anymore, boom. And Steve was just standing up there like a statue. And he had just, it's this incredible physique. He was just ripped, just naturally ripped. And that flowing red hair, he had his arms crossed and he was just sitting there with his hair in the wind and he would not move. I drove by 5 or 6 times and he's just standing there on the top of this tree. And that seems like, you know, that would be fairly easy to do, right? I mean, it's the size pretty much of this table that I'm sitting at. But most of you have probably realized that the higher you get, the more difficult it is to actually stand or walk on something that is the size of a sidewalk or stand on something the size of a table. It's because you get vertigo. Now, I have no fear of heights, and I always tell people there really is no fear of heights. There's just a fear of falling. And he knew he would not fall, right? And he just did it because it tickled him, because people would ride by and stare. And I just remember going back and forth and going, what a weird, weird dude. What a strange, strange man. But I admired him a lot. And we went on many, many, many adventures. And I could tell you all kinds of stories. Favorite stories about Steve, about Tarzan, is when we were in one of the local wetlands and we were canoeing our way through Buffalo Swamp. and we found this really solid tree, because most of the trees that are out in wetlands, they really are not made for the wetlands the way like the cypress are down in, you know, South Georgia and Florida. They just kind of got flooded, and some of them don't do very well, but this one was pretty stout. And we sort of tucked our canoes away, and we climbed to the top of this tree. And we climbed pretty high, and Steve was above me. And here come these two guys in this little John boat. These two fishermen, right? And they're talking to each other, and they got beers, and they're talking about their women and all the stuff's going on, and spitting, you know, snuff out of the sides of their mouth. And right when they got under us, and see, we just had this strange thing that we did. We loved to be able to hide in plain sight. And it just gave us a thrill to be standing or hovering or somewhere where people should see us. But because people are so locked into their world, they don't look around. People don't look up. They don't look around. And they just kind of just go into this tunnel vision. And we used to just love to make fun of it. I don't think we ever really talked about why we loved it so much. But all of a sudden, right as they got under us, there was this massive cracking sound. And there goes Steve. I see him falling. And I said he didn't fall, but this time he did, because he put his weight on a branch that didn't support it. And he had to be 60 feet easily in the air. And he hit three or four limbs on the way down, branches. He was trying to grab them, and I'm surprised he was not able to, because that's the kind of guy he was. But he hit the water right in front of the boat. And I mean, he hit with a great baboosh. And it wasn't but like 5 or 6 feet deep. So he hit mud, and there's this massive mushroom cloud of just dark brown mud that just goes exploding through this black water. And these guys are just completely surprised. And then he comes up out of the water. He's covered with mud. He's got little sticks in his long flowing red hair. And he just takes off half running, half swimming through the swamp, trying to get away because he's just revealed himself. He's embarrassed himself. He wants to get away. He doesn't want these guys, we don't even know who they are, to catch him. And so they take off after him and finally stop him. They never looked up in the tree. There were three more of us up there, and they never looked up in the tree. This is what I'm talking about, people getting tunnel vision. We did a trip out west, and trust me, Steve is not the kind of guy you wanted to mess with. He did not play organized sports, and as a junior, the high school football coach sought him out, legendary coach Ben Parker, and he sought him out, and he said, Tarzan, we got to get you on the team. We need you. We need you bad. And so he agreed to play, and they put him on defensive end, and he won every single game, every single week. They had the Headhunter Award. He didn't play on offense at all. He just played defense. And the Headhunter Award went to the people with the most tackles, the most sacks, the hardest hits. And that's who this guy was. And when we were out west, 1980, traveling across the country, we were up in Oregon, and we were staying in this, I guess what you would call a bed and breakfast. And he developed an ingrown toenail. And he complained about it quite a bit. And we had this pool room. We had this billiard room. We were playing pool out there. And for some reason, I have no idea why, I didn't think about his ingrown toenail. We were just standing there. And somebody else was shooting. One of my other two friends was shooting. And I just took my pool cue and let it slide. I kind of held it up and let it slide through my fingers and let it hit him in the foot. And when I did it, he just reeled back in the most horrible look of pain I've ever seen come across anybody's face. And then I realized, oh my God, I have just committed suicide. And his gaze came down on me, and I'm one of his best friends, and he's still my soulmate to this day, but he was going to tear my head off. And the other two guys intervened, and he was just going, why did you do that? I have no idea, man. I'm so sorry. You would not want this guy on you. I promise you. You would not want this guy on you. His abilities to do things were absolutely amazing. We had a gym in our hometown. It was called the Ava Sewell Hall. Now, if I said Coach Ben Parker, please forgive me. It was Coach Ben Perkins. I'm thinking about somebody else, and I don't want to insult his legacy or his history. But we had this this gym. It's where our basketball team played, and we had our pep rallies and stuff. It's where we graduated. And Ava Sewell Hall had these. It was an old school building. It still stands today. And it came, the front and the back came to these concrete peaks. They had this tin galvanized roof, and we figured out a way to use these leveler windows at the very, very top, you know, benches up there, and they would just kind of go eek, and they would just go out at an angle, and we could sneak out, and actually it would support our weight, and we could pull ourselves up. And just getting on top of the hall was one thing. But then they had these sort of, I don't know what you would call them, bulstrums, or, you know, they were concrete walls that came up to a point. Now, these points had to be, I'm going to say again, probably 55, 60 feet over the concrete that surrounded it, the parking lot. And he could walk, and we measured him one time. He walked over a mile on his hands. He could walk on his hands like nobody's business. He was strong. He had incredible balance. And it was just one of the things he was very good at. And he would actually do a handstand on the apex of one of these, you know, points. And when he was doing the handstand, he would, you know, be starting, obviously, on the top of the building, and he would just kind of kip up, and he would slowly rise his body, and his knees would kind of bend over so he'd get his balance over the precipice, and then he would actually remove a hand and would do a one-hand handstand on the top of this building, and one mistake would have sent him falling to his death, but of course, he never made that mistake. One of my other friends that hung out with us, too, who I've mentioned before, Jim Osier, could do the same thing, but Jim would do it kind of on the sly. He's been that kind of guy all his life. He doesn't really look for attention. Steve enjoyed that little bit of attention that he would get for doing crazy things. And he could leap from rock to rock. It was just amazing. His confidence level was through the roof. So one of the greatest characters I've ever known. Everybody, my new friends that I made when I went to college, when I moved to Tennessee, all love these guys. My wife, Rebecca Cruz Stiles, one of the sweetest, loveliest women in the world. Family's from Venezuela. She'd never met anybody like this. Upon meeting them for the first time, when we walked away, she said, "Those may be the very best human beings I've ever met on the planet." So that's the kind of character of the people we're talking about. And Steve, when I broke my leg back in 2017, and it was a very bad break, and it ended up with several operations and surgeries. We'll get back to the emergency room here in a little bit. The day I got home, I'd just gotten out of the car. I'm feeling very sorry for myself because I'm going to be laid up for a while. And I got a call from my sister, and Steve's son had actually mistakenly, accidentally backed over his own child, a beautiful young girl, on his way to work on a Saturday, and she died. And the entire town turned out for the funeral. I could not go because of my injury. But you talk about putting things into perspective. Suddenly, I did not feel so sorry for myself. And he and I have had many, many, many conversations about it ever since. I will try to make sure that I get some pictures and video to Strat of this guy doing some remarkable things, or at least just hanging out. I just want to say thanks to Steve for being my friend. Now, he comes back into play here. Mexico. I've been a couple of times. Actually, he and I and our group, when we were traveling out west, went into Mexico, and I'd been there before. And back in 2000, though, I went down with a group called the Adventure Guild. And it was me and six other guys, some of whom I knew, some of whom I did not. And we went down to climb the second highest mountain in North America, the highest being, of course, Denali. And climbing Denali, or what used to be Mount McKinley, is really just a trek. It's more like Kilimanjaro. You do have snow, and you do have, you know, risk of bad weather, but it's really just, it's a 20-mile trek to get to the top. The mountain in Mexico is called Orizaba. Now, that's not what they call it. The locals, they still use this sort of Mayan dialect that has no vowels in it whatsoever. But we'll call it Orizaba, and you can look it up, and it's just a hair under 19,000 feet. It's 809,093 feet, if I'm not mistaken. Nobody's ever heard of it, but it's popular among climbers because it gets you to the point where you're actually at elevation, where you start need to thinking about using oxygen. And a lot of people who want to be real mountain climbers, they have no idea how they're going to react to altitude. You can be in the best shape of your life, but still altitude sickness can take you down. And this, again, this is a much shorter trek. You fly into Mexico City, which is a trip. You're going over the desert, so it's very bumpy. There's thermals breaking off everywhere. It's always going to be a bumpy ride. And when you fly into Mexico City, which is a massive city, I don't know how many millions of people live there, 14, 20 million, the planes come in and they bank and they go down the main highways of town. They're literally coming in under the levels of the skyscrapers. You're looking out the windows of the plane and you're catching eye contact with people working in offices. It's not set out away from the city the way most places are. It's a trip to go in there. Then we made our way down to Puebla, a town of 3 million people, beautiful town. It's even at higher elevation than Mexico City is. And a couple of interesting adventures there. And then we made our way to the small town at the foot of Orizaba, where I immediately started rethinking why I was doing this. I'd been in training for it for a long time. It was an adventure. I was 2000, that would make me 40. I was 40 years old. I was 39, about to turn 40. And it was a big year down there because that was the year that the PRI, the big party down there that had held control for over two decades, was defeated by Vicente Fox, who seemed like he was going to be a savior, but he turned out just to be another Mexican politician. But I mean, the politics were in the air. It was kind of an electric time. Now, you start out at this one little village, and that's pretty cool. That's a cool place. I mean, every day they set up a huge market, and these three-year-old kids are out there. They know exactly what to do. Everybody's got a job. And I remember the first night that we spent there, this drunken man came wheeling up to our table at one of the two or three restaurants they actually had there. And he told us that he would be the guy that would be coming to rescue us on the mountain if something happened. And we're like going, of course, that's correct. And we dubbed him Senor Borracho, you know, the Mr. Drunk. And the next morning, sure enough, he comes out and he is the guy that would actually come rescue us if something happened on the mountain. That very day, a Russian climber fell to his death. So this is not just some easy thing. I saw where another person died just recently on Orizaba, and I had on my show the first amputee to ever summit Everest. This was about 5 years ago, lost his arm on Orizaba. We go up to this little bitty town called Hidalgo. It is the highest settlement, human settlement, anywhere in North America. They're at about somewhere around 13,000 feet. Now, in Telluride, you go up to the town, and then you can actually go up to the summits where people ski, and some people even hang glide. That's about 13,000 feet. In this little bitty town, they live there, and they don't speak Spanish. They don't speak English. They speak their own language, an indigenous language, but beautiful people. And they live right on the edge of this cliff. And at this point now, we have burros with all of our gear. And the burros are taking our gear up with us to the base camp. And I'll take it back. They're at 11,000 feet because the base camp was at 13,000. So they're at 11,000 feet, still the highest human settlement in North America. And we're huffing and we're puffing. And I mean, it's tough to get air up there, even though we've been training and training and training and training. And I remember watching the kids play soccer. And if they kicked the ball too hard and it went off the side of the mountain, that ball was gone. It's not like they had a whole lot of money to get new balls. All right. So I remember at one point somebody kicked it pretty hard and I was kind of sitting over there near the edge and they were shouting what I can only assume was a little help, you know, helps out, you know. So I got up and I kind of stopped the ball and I walked over there and I rolled it to them. And I realized I was completely out of breath. And here these kids are out there running back and forth. shows you where acclimation can get you. And none of the people in the town below or this town had ever climbed to the top of the mountain. They had no purpose to do so. They didn't understand why anybody did. But, you know, we supported them with money and bought stuff from them, so they were happy. They got their actual water supply from the glacier, which is still there. It's one of the few that hasn't completely dissipated that I know of. And we went up to the base camp, which is a block building that just sits up there in this very arid, rocky place covered with snow and ice. And there were a couple of folks from the village that were working on their water supply. And, you know, occasionally boulders would roll into the, you know, the little viaduct. And so we shared space. I remember there's a reason for me telling you all this. And we had to share space with these guys as they worked. And at night, we spent a couple of days there to make sure that we were good at 13,000 feet. And our team leader who had done more climbing than anybody did get altitude sickness. And if you get it, you will die from it. There's only one cure, and that is to go back down. You have to go back down. You have to spend a little bit of time at lower elevation. Then you can come back up and give it another shot. It had never happened to him. So he had to leave. And for 2 days, we hung out there, and he showed back up. And so now the summit attempt is back in our sights. And they even had a little list of people who had died in that building from getting altitude sickness and not going back down, just being stubborn. So it gets your attention. And here's how it all went down. We went to 16,000 feet at one point and made a base camp. Most miserable night of my life up until that time. I was in an Arctic bag that was given to me by a guy named Dawson Wheeler. I know Dawson has been on with my friend Clint Powell here on his podcast several times. And he started a business with Marvin Webb called Rock Creek Outfitters, which just took over the world when it came to, you know, outdoor gear, especially that, you know, you could take in direct mail, get in direct mail. And Dawson had given me his Arctic bag. And so I'm laying there and I'm in the bag and I'm sweating profusely. It's just so hot. And so I throw the bag off and it's so cold. I could literally hear the ice freeze. My sweat would freeze. It would just go across my chest and my arms, whatever was exposed. I'd go back in the bag. I did this all night. And when we got up the next day, we realized the mountain was just socked in. There's no way we were going to be able to make the attempt. So we went back down to the base camp. And at some point we decided, we made the decision. You know, you can't beat the mountain. The mountain will beat you. If you try to trick it, it's the mountains are tricksters, and they can mess you up in a heartbeat. Just look at the situation on Everest that, you know, made so much of a big boom with into the mist, into thin air, the John Krakauer book Into Thin Air, and all the people that died up there because of the sudden storm that came rolling in. And we said, well, we're not going to be able to make it. So the next day, we're going to go to either Acapulco or Veracruz. Mexico had not yet then become the murder capital of the world. So either way, we'd be on one side of the isthmus down there, and we would be going to some sort of beautiful either Caribbean or sort of Central South Pacific place and do some cliff diving. We were all excited about it, and we were disappointed we weren't going to be able to summit. But all of a sudden, 3 o'clock in the morning, the team leader who had gotten back from having to descend because of altitude sickness looks out the window and he goes, it's clear. The mountain's clear. And there were stars everywhere. So we got up in the dark and we're just stumbling around. And the Mexican workers that were there or the village workers that were there were all excited for us. And we got our stuff together in our packs and we took off and we went off on what we had to do it in one day. We had to get to the top and we took off. And I have a picture that I took right at sunrise. And people really don't believe me, but it was about the place where we camped at 16,000 feet. And it was the last real rock outcropping you saw until you got to the very top. It is a volcano. As a matter of fact, there are three volcanoes that loom over Puebla, and you see them in the distance if you see any pictures of that town. And Popo is the one that's always erupting. Popo is always erupting, but it's just smoke and ash, but it's going to go off one day. Orizaba has been still for a long, 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 long time. I think they've had a couple of trembles in the last couple of years, but it's got a big caldera at the top. But once we leave that area, it's just nothing but glacier, just this huge, steep sheet of ice. But I took this picture, and you can see the curvature of the earth. Because Mexico City is so polluted, you could not see the city. But it just, the pollution added to the picture at sunrise. It was beautiful. And people don't believe it, but you can literally see the earth curve from this mountain. And think about, you know, Everest being at 29,000 feet, another 10,000 feet. And trust me, every 100 feet when you get up there starts making a big, big difference in the way you react. So we zig and we zag and we zig and we zag. There's no way to go straight up. You cannot do it. Nobody, Herschel Walker, back when he was playing for the Dogs, did not have the thigh power to go straight up. So you're, it's like the Grand Canyon, though, for those of you who have ever made that trip. All you can do is go left and then go right, and you're having to bust snow the whole time. And I would take about three steps, stop and breathe. Everybody did the same thing. Three steps, stop and breathe. And I was advised to get a mantra, which I did. And it was at that time, my wife, her name was Crystal, but her real name was Crystalline. And so I used Crystal Lynn, left, right. And you just become a machine. You can't think about anything else. You can't think about the misery. You can't think about, I can't do this. You just have to keep on going and keep on going and keep on going. And by God, we got there. But here's the trick. The guys that were in back of us, me and a guy named Mike Pollock, the guy that ran the Adventure Guild, we were in front, and we actually went to a false summit. We went to what we thought was the top, but we went to a point on the caldera. That's the part of the volcano where the big cone is, and then realized that the summit was about no more than 200 feet away. 200 feet away. And the other guys past us did not make that mistake and kept on going. And Mike said, come on, man, let's go. It's just right there. And I sat down in the snow and just said, I'm good. I'm fine. This is far enough for me. I will be satisfied. And here's a guy who's already tried to do this three times and has been foiled every time. And he looks at me and goes, if you don't go, I can't go. Oh, my God. So I get up and I start walking. And that last 200 feet took forever. This is where Steve comes back in. At some point, I look to my left, and right there at the edge of the volcano is my buddy Tarzan. And he's wearing nothing but a pair of denim cutoffs. And when he got real excited, as manly as he was, his voice would get real high and squealy like a girl. And he'd just get all kinds of antsy. And to say, the guy didn't party, he didn't drink, he didn't smoke, he didn't do any of that stuff. Never puffed a joint in his entire life. And he'd just get so excited when people would do things and stretch their boundaries. And he was just clapping. He was going, man, come on, man. Oh, I'm so proud of you. And I looked at Mike and I go, man, I am severely hallucinating. And Mike looked back at me. He goes, I'm pretty sure we all are. And but Tarzan's help, By applauding me and being so happy for me, pushed me forward. And I looked up, and at the very summit, which our other friends had reached, there was what I assumed a crashed plane. It was just a bunch of rugged, wrecked metal at the top. And I thought, well, some plane just went, you know, nose in up there. But as we got to the top, I realized it was actually a cross that had been made out of small pieces of rebar and metal that people had carried in their packs up there. I didn't realize it was part of the tradition. I didn't take one, but there was this cross that had been just ruggedly constructed at the very top, and our friends were there, and for about 5 minutes, it seemed warm, and the wind quit blowing, and we hugged each other, and we cried, and it was just this amazing moment. And then it got cold again, and the wind started blowing, and we had to go down. All right. This whole story, I'm going to go back to that last night at the base camp inside that house. The men that had been working on the water supply had been joined by a couple of kids. Not young kids, teenage boys. And they had brought Game Boys with them. And here on our last night, when we thought we were going to have it to be leaving, they were playing these Game Boys at full volume. And the men kept telling them to shut up and turn them off. And they'd shut up and turn them off for a minute. And all of a sudden, I don't know what they were playing, Donkey Kong, something. And it was just ridiculous how much noise they made. And the men kept getting angrier. And the young teenage boys kept getting more defiant. But, I mean, I just couldn't figure out why they couldn't turn them down or put on some sort of earbuds. I don't know if earbuds existed back then. But I just remember thinking, what a rude thing to do. What a bizarre cultural thing to do. And, of course, like we do now, we wonder why our kids would bury their faces in a game when they're in a place of incredible natural beauty. Now, that gets me back to what has happened to me just recently. I have mentioned on my show several times, and to anybody who would listen, and I think on the podcast, I've been dealing with some internal issues, just gut problems for quite some time now. And then here recently, I got an infection in my throat and ear, and it became very frustrating, and it was messing up my voice, and I was missing work. So I went to see a doctor. I had a standing appointment with one doctor, somebody who was going to be my new GP, and a guy that my wife went to and worked at the hospital where she works, and I liked him. He checked in on me a couple of times when my leg was broken and I was at the hospital. But I went to see a doc in the box, and he gave me a steroid pack. It was a viral infection, not a whole lot of antibiotics could do. I'd only taken a steroid pack once in my life, and it had a profoundly negative effect on me. I mean, I became murderous. I know these things don't bother most people, but I apparently am just very sensitive to them. I could eat two Quaaludes and still, you know, skateboard down a hill. But, you know, back in the day, or eat acid and still be able to talk to a cop if I got pulled over. But I steroids just messed me up. And I told him that. And he said, well, there's not a whole lot we could do. So I decided, well, a lot of time's passed. Let me give it another shot. I took a day and a half worth of these steroids, and I didn't become murderous. But I did just get sicker and sicker, and I wasn't understanding why. When I went to my standing appointment with the new GP guy, my standing heart rate was something like 150, and my blood pressure was unmeasurable. And he said, essentially, you've been having a low-grade heart attack all day. So he took the steroid pack away from me, and he threw it in the trash with a great flurry, and he said, never do that again. And we put myself on a long-range health plan that's going to include some injections and checkups and things of this nature, and I went home. That night I had this thing I could only describe as a massive gastric attack. It felt like my appendix was exploding. It felt like I was having some sort of, you know, colon blockage or bowel blockage, and it was going to make my intestines just burst out of my side like an alien. I was going to die like that poor young girl in Poltergeist did. It was so painful. And I was in the kitchen just leaning over this chair and just screaming in pain. And it burned and it hurt and it was just cramped. And my wife's trying to get me to go to the ER, but it lasted about 30 minutes and then it subsided. And I said, it's okay. I'm okay. I'm through the worst of it. Assumed it was just after effects of the steroids. Well, the next day, I started throwing up. Thursday at lunch was the last full meal I had. That was right before I went to see the good doctor. I did not eat again until Tuesday morning about 1:30 a.m. Not a bite, because I couldn't keep anything down. So I threw up on Friday, Saturday. On Sunday, I did nothing but vomit all day long. And I mean, I was completely empty. I had no contents in my stomach. I could not even drink water. I couldn't take the medication that I had for high blood pressure because I would throw it right back up again. Just a miserable night. I was completely dehydrated. And I've been thirsty. I've been dehydrated many times. I was without any fluid in my body. That morning, I was able to take one high blood pressure pill with a swallow of Gatorade and keep it down. So I told my wife, she's saying, you're coming in with me. We're going to the ER. And I said, let me just get a little sleep. Let me just sleep for maybe 3 hours and I'll be okay. Bad idea. I drive myself off the mountain when I finally get up. It took me forever just to put my clothes on. I'm talking about jeans and a t-shirt. And I was just soaking in sweat. My equilibrium was off because my ear was still messed up. The steroid pack did seem to be helping my ear infection, but it came roaring back. I'm driving off the mountain where we live. It's about 1,500 feet over the valley. I'm going downhill. I realize my equilibrium's terrible. My balance is terrible. I'm in this cold, clammy sweat. And I'm going, Jeff, this is a bad idea. You shouldn't be doing this, but I'm now committed. My phone rang a million times on the way in because this is now the third day of work that I've missed. And people were beginning to get really worried about me. But I made it to the ER and I walked in and everything, every symptom I had simulated that of a heart attack. So they treated me very quickly, called my name. The doctors were very concerned and they, you know, yes, my blood pressure was again immeasurable. My pulse rate was just stupid. And they got me back into the, you know, innards of the emergency room, the dungeon deep down of disease and death and despair, where all these professionals, I talked to no less than seven doctors in a flurry. And my wife was there the whole time. She left her job in the next building next door at the foundation that helps run the hospital. And she came and stayed with me the whole time. And all seven doctors gave me seven different prognoses and seven different reasons why they thought it was happening. I'm not getting down on them. I'm just saying that was the kind of situation it was. It was just a mystery illness. And it was just an amazing amount of attention that I was getting. And she stayed there. I think I got there at 11:30 a.m. And finally, one of the doctors came at 8 p.m. and said, we have you a room. And so I told my wife to please go home. She had a big event coming up. Remember, this is still going someplace. And so she went home. Well, I didn't see another doctor after that. It was an incredibly busy night. I could hear the squawking of all the different scanner traffic that was going on. And I'm still laying there on a stretcher, essentially a gurney. And I laid there and laid there and laid there. And I was not in some sort of private room. I was in this room where several other patients were. And there were three in particular. And I never did get in a room, by the way. It just was one of those kind of crazy times. But I was fairly miserable. But I took eight bags of fluid, saline solution fluid, whatever they give you when you're dehydrated, eight over the course of less than 24 hours. That's how dehydrated I was. There were three people that shared the room with me that got my attention. There was a guy that I could not see, but he recognized my voice, and he was a listener for years and years and years of my talk radio show, and he was just tickled to death to be able to kind of meet me. And he was in there because he just herniated himself at work. And they took him away for surgery. And then here comes this very kind, gentle-looking older lady, like something straight out of, you know, the Waltons. His clothes, abrasions everywhere. I have no idea what kind of injuries he had. But then she speaks, and they're German. And they spoke back and forth, and he never raised up. He never opened his eyes, but they were speaking. They would speak both in English and German. And I just remember hearing this. And I understand a little German because I've spent a summer there with my best friend from Ohio, and I could understand a lot more than I could speak, just like Spanish. And I could make out this much, that they'd been in a car wreck. And earlier, I'd heard some police department scanner traffic that there had been a car wreck and somebody had run. And she spoke suddenly with this very whispery voice in English. She said, I guess they murdered that poor boy. I still don't know what that situation is because I haven't actually been out of the hospital long enough. I felt an obligation to come in here and do this because you guys have paid money. And if, by the way, if you haven't, please subscribe just a little bit or a lot. to fredpodcast.com. I will try to continue to give you decent content, but the people who have and have done lifetime subscriptions, I think they're like $400, I owe them something. But it was just incredible listening to this. And then they actually came and very quietly took them into a more private area because of their age and the trauma that they'd been through. And here it comes, the Mexico thing. They bring in this guy on a gurney, put him in the exact same spot, and he's out. Apparently he's had a stroke. And they walk away just for a little bit, and it's dark. And he wakes up, and at this point I'm sitting up on the stretcher. You know, I just had to stretch. And I must have looked like death on a cracker. I mean, I'd just been sweating profusely. I was miserable, and I'd just been through this hellish day. And I was sitting up, and I was just kind of looking at him. And man, it freaked him out. And he started wrestling with his clothes and the sheets, and he was looking at me terrified. And he was about to come out of the little, you know, they had the rails up, but he was banging on them. And I was going, cuidado, cuidado, mi hermano, just, you know, be careful, be calm. And I shouted for nurses, and they came in. They didn't even realize that he did not speak English. So they went and got a doctor who spoke Spanish, and they calmed him down. And then here come these two ladies who are, one is his wife and one is his daughter. His daughter is tremendously pregnant. She is very pregnant. She's got a SARS mask on. And because she doesn't want to catch any germs in the, you know, the emergency room. And they do speak some English, and they calm the guy down. And this doctor did a great job with his Spanish and getting the guy to sort of chill. And, I just laid back and I started listening to him. And I realized that I was going to not sleep at all that night. Even if they come in and give me some sort of sedative, which I don't think they ever planned to do. But because they were calling their family on their phones, and it hearkened me back to the kids with the Game Boys on the mountain. All the phones were at full volume. The ringtones were obnoxious. They talked in their outside regular voices, whether it was in English or Spanish, it didn't make any difference. And they played funny videos and funny songs and all kinds of stuff. And it was really beginning to irritate the shit out of me. I was beginning to get very angry. I'd had a bad day. Why wasn't I in my room? Why wasn't I getting some help? All I'd gotten was fluids so far. And they explained to me, and rightfully so, they had to eliminate the things that they thought might be wrong with me before they could actually start taking any kind of action to help me. And I still couldn't eat. And I'm hungry. I'm just so frustrated. And I was about to go off. I was about to go total redneck and just start really screaming at them, you rude people, turn those damn phones off. I'm sick of this. And at some point, they quieted down. And it wasn't because of anything I said, because I never did. And I must have drifted off for a second, not long, because when I woke up, I heard this very light voice. The young daughter was singing a lullaby, just almost inaudible to the human hearing level. And it was just this little lullaby. And then she started talking to her baby, and then she started moaning. And I thought, my God, is she masturbating? And then she started moaning louder. And then she started talking louder to her baby. And then she started really groaning in pain. And I realized, my God, she's going into labor right there in the emergency room in the room with me. And the father and the mother didn't say anything to anybody. And this young lady, and I'm sure that they have totally different ways of delivering babies where they came from. They seem to be from out in the outback of Mexico and kind of the places I was describing, not from, you know, one of the big cities. And what they were doing here, I have no idea. But she literally, at one point, she was going, please live, please live. And the only thing I ever said, and I know it startled them, is I just said, it will live, it will be okay. And the next thing I know, her water broke. And somebody, one of the nurses or doctors, walked by and realized what was happening. And there was a flurry of, and the guy was getting ready to go in for an MRI for a stroke. They were taking him in for x-rays and MRI, and they actually took him away, and they were dealing with having this baby at the same time. And I remember hearing one of the doctors going, "My God, this is happening fast." And she had that baby in the emergency room, and they took her into an inspection room and made sure she was okay and brought her back. And no more than 30 minutes, she was back before the father was. And I just thought to myself how proud I was of myself, how lucky I was, how glad I was that I had not gone off on them and become the typical dumbass, redneck, angry American shouting at a foreigner. And I'd even told one of the nurses that came in to check on me, I said, "This is going to be an interesting night. There's a difference in our cultures, and it's going to be loud, and I'm going to be hearing all kinds of rackety noises all night, and that's okay. I'll be in a room here in a little bit." Never got to the room. But I am so glad I did not terrify them or make a complete fool of myself. And the one thing I said was at least reassuring. And I was able to leave the next day, which nobody could have foreseen. The doctors, as a team, came to me and said, "We have eliminated all of the things that we thought were wrong. We have several tests to still conduct on the amount of blood that we took from you, which was about 1,400 gallons. And at this point, you might as well go home and rest. And, you know, we can just do this through office visits. We're going to figure out what's wrong with you." So really, I don't feel a ton better than I did when I went in, with the exception of the fact that I'm no longer dehydrated. But it's not about me. It was about me holding my tongue in that one moment. And I realized it didn't matter what I said. It didn't matter how much right I had to say it. It would have hit them as being bluntly racist and completely inappropriate. And it would have just burned an image into their brains of the type of person that they were going to be around even when they were seeking help. And I thank God that I did not turn into that person. And I thank God, and I thank you guys. I thank anybody out there who has advertised, who's helped me from the very beginning, Jeff Brakebill and Aretha Frankenstein's, the RMJ folks, all the rest of the people who've stepped forward and anonymously made donations when I was out of work and out of salary and out of pay. And all the subscribers out there, fredpodcast.com, and of course, RC2, Realty Solutions, Robin Ring, just a beautiful lady, and she's gone through some health problems of her own. I've not talked to her in quite some time, and I need to my new employers at Nuga Radio, and they've been very understanding, and the guy that owns the place has told me again and again that he is more concerned about helping me heal from all these things I've been through than he is with me showing up every day and helping him get ratings. And I cannot tell you how rare that is in the world of radio today. To Tim Kelly and all of his staff, and Kelly Subaru, kellysubaru.com, thank you. And I appreciate you guys listening. And I know that was a very strange, odd journey, but I wanted to talk about characters because I said I was going to, and I wanted to talk about what happened to me in the ER. And then I thought about that connection and that trip to Mexico and why I already knew going in that there was going to be some problems with the audio that night in that tight room. But for the moment, I'm okay. And I will be doing another one of these possibly tomorrow, depending on how I feel. But you'll have another one very soon. And it will be the third and final chapter of Jeff Styles America and jeffstylesamerica.com, where you can get these podcasts. And you can get them at Google Cast, and you can get them at, you know, Anchor FM, and you can get them wherever podcasts, you know, leap from. But Jeff Styles America was the original podcast name because an old buddy of mine came in and sang a little theme song one day on the air when I told another unlikely story that would only happen to me. And he just had this little jingle thing. He went, "Only in Jeff Styles America." And I was so frustrated that I couldn't tell my story about what happened to me last year when I got shot in a road rage incident that cost me my job. And it was the only way I could do it. And I thought I would do it over a period of time, but really I got it off my chest in two podcasts. But the third one is coming up. All the charges have been expunged and, you know, completely taken off the record. And so I'm going to get my last shot in at the people who I think really screwed me over and get some, you know, thanks out to the people who helped me. And that's coming up soon, too. But yeah, this one definitely falls into the Only in Jeff Styles America category. It did make the news, by the way. The incident, the woman giving birth while her dad was being treated for a stroke in the emergency room, did make the news. So there I was, just sitting there silently, at first frustrated and then just sort of reeling at this magical moment. And I wish I could tell you what the lullaby was, but it was so soft and so slow, but I will never forget the sound of it. Thank you for listening.